Today, it is our privilege to take you on a journey through one of the most respected and revered wine countries in the world. It has been a long-time goal of the Grape Encounters team to spend an extended period of time exploring the state of Oregon's breathtaking Willamette Valley. Known mostly for its world-class Pinots, the raves these Burgundian wines are getting is just a small part of the story. That's why your host, David Wilson, decided to pack his bags and devote an entire month of Grape Encounters to a full immersion, deep dive into the wines of Northwest Oregon. So climb aboard the Grape Encounters transporter as we whisk you away on our second week in the breathtaking, very hospitable, and world-class Willamette Valley of Northwest Oregon.
Peel me a grape, crush me some ice, skin me a peach, save the fuzz for my pillow.
All right, and it is time for your Grape Encounter of the Week as we continue, I'm going to call it our Oregon Wine Odyssey, because we're spending weeks and weeks in Oregon. It's something that I have felt very, very guilty about. I have to admit it. I have neglected Oregon in a very big way, and I am paying my dues now by coming to Oregon, and especially the Willamette Valley, bringing you, you know, so many wonderful people and so many wonderful wines on Grape Encounters. Well, today we are sitting in a picture-perfect spot with an absolutely fascinating, charming, and delightful guest. We are at Grand Moraine, which is a winery that is actually owned by Kendall Jackson. It was a brand that they started from scratch, and I am with Eugenia Keegan, who is a legend here in the area, and you're looking at, well, you have sunglasses on. I can't actually tell whether your eyes lit up or whether you just poo-pooed me. Welcome to the show.
Well, Ulysses, how's this odyssey going for you?
I'm thinking, she doesn't know my name.
Yeah, she doesn't know my name.
This odyssey is really a blast.
Good.
And you came from California to Oregon, so you know how good this feels, you know, to come up here, I guess, right? 19 years?
Yeah, 19 years up here. I do know how good it feels. Of course, I have to admit, I miss a little of the sunshine that we get so abundantly in California. But we're sitting in a beautiful sunny day right now with puffy clouds, and vineyards are growing healthily, and the flowers are out, and I don't think we could ask for much more.
All right. So first of all, let's talk about you for a second.
You've been
in the biz for a long time, right?
Yeah, just over 40 years making wine.
You know what I'm curious about is how many women were making wine 40 years ago? Almost none, right?
Yeah, there were really only a couple of us. There was Selma Long and Marianne Graff and just a handful of women who were making wine. Kathy Corson got started pretty early.
How were you treated in those days?
Actually, really well, I have to say. I know people want to beat up the boys, but I was always well treated by the men. And in fact, several were mentors. They supported me, helped me in the industry, dragged me along, made me take notes at their meetings and all that sort of stuff.
So you wind up over here. We're not going to get deep into this, but I think you chased a boy.
I did. I chased a boy up to Oregon. He was not having anything to do with California. So if I wanted to see him more than the first couple of weeks, I had to ultimately move to Oregon. And I'm very, very happy that I did. Not just because the relationship is great and we're still happily together, but I love Oregon. I have fallen in love with Oregon.
Yeah, there's a lot to love here.
Yeah.
But you know what? I think every wine country has its own distinct personality, and I love them all.
Yeah, I do.
They're all my children.
Yeah.
Okay.
You're really quite a prolific dad.
I am. Anyway, the one thing I do wonder about making wine in Oregon, though, is that you seem not to have as many varietals to play with, or is it that you choose not to play with as many varietals here as in a place like California?
Well, it's important to distinguish where you are in Oregon.
Because well, right now we're in the Willamette Valley.
Correct.
Okay.
Because if you're in southern Oregon, where there's a lot more heat, you have a lot more varieties that you can work with.
Okay, that is true, yes.
But when you're here in the Willamette Valley, there are a lot of white wines that can grow and produce fabulous wines. We don't produce a lot of additional white wines. We're limited to three or four, but it's really white wine country. And the one red that we can ripen is Pinot Noir. And there's a couple of acres here and there of Grenache and Syrah, but the truth is they don't really ripen as well as they do in warmer climates. So it's not the best suited for where we are.
I'm just curious about this. When you go to some place like the Finger Lakes in New York, where they make, you know, you see Cab Franc there, you see Cabernet there, you see, you know, the Rieslings there. Of course, they seem to grow a lot more variety in that very cold climate than here in the northern part of the state. Is there a reason for that that you can point to?
We're just that much cooler.
You mean in the summertime?
Yeah, you're thinking, you know, how cold it is in the winter.
Right, but nobody really cares about winter anyway, right?
Nor do the vines.
The vines just shut down and go.
Yeah, they're sound asleep. We are far enough north that you can just barely ripen Pinot Noir in a cool vintage.
The other thing is, I think that winemakers up here are obsessed with Pinot envy. And you want...
No, David, the rest of the world is obsessed with Pinot envy because of what we have.
Well, that's what I meant.
Yeah.
I meant that you want them to envy you.
They do.
And you're obsessed with showing them.
Yeah, we're very proud of the Pinots we make. There's no question about it. And we have six different AVAs, and they all produce a slightly different wine. And that gives us some variety within the context of making Pinot Noir.
And I've learned something, that one thing you never say to a winemaker here is that, wow, these Oregon Pinots are as good as... You don't ever say that, right?
You got to be a little careful with that.
You'll find yourself tumbling in the dirt.
Yeah.
And the door locked behind you.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah, there is definitely the belief here that Oregon is the one to beat now. And they say it loud and proud here, and there's a lot of reason to believe that to be true.
Well, thank you for that. We are very proud of the wines we make. We've been making wine here for 50 years. It's hard to believe, because our reputation is more recent than that. But that 50 years has been a lot of experimentation in the vineyard and in the winery. And a lot of the winemakers have come up from California, of course, had to rethink the way they grow grapes and make wine. And we've learned from each other. There's a lot of collaboration, a lot of support from your neighbors. And we've learned together. And I think we've moved very quickly into being a world-class Pinot Noir growing region.
So one of the things that I do find interesting is that there are, and I've said this a couple of times on prior shows, that there are three places that I enjoy Pinot the most from, and it happens to be Oregon, Russian River, and then the Santa Lucia Highlands.
Yeah.
There are three places that I really enjoy the Pinots from. So it must have been interesting coming from Russian River to here, because there are some similarities. You know, you certainly can tell the difference for sure. Do you have a preference? I mean, honestly. Or is it about the time of the day and what you're having for dinner? And
I think if I have a preference, it's the structural components that you get in this cooler climate. And in the warmer climates, you tend to lose a little of that acid. So probably that's the one thing that I like about Oregon wines a little bit more. And the Burgundian wines have that same cool climate, higher acid.
You're about food wines, right?
I am about food wines. Yes.
Okay. Are there wines that you would sit down and just enjoy without any food at all, just to enjoy it? I like to say that a food wine, my definition of a food wine is a wine that serves as a meal replacement.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. Just sit there and drink the bottle.
Yeah.
You know, it's lower in calories that way.
I absolutely get that.
Looking at me like,
no, I'm not, because
that's
it's
a dorky thing to say.
I'm like, how do you know how I live? I didn't know you had cameras in my house. But, we're going to go into true confessions here. When I drink a wine, let's say before dinner or even at 3 o'clock in the afternoon or any other time that I decide to drink wine.
I think we have a wino on our hands here, folks.
Yeah. Thank you for that term, wino. That's a polite euphemism for probably what I really am. But sometimes when it's early in the day like that and you don't want to drink that much wine and all of that early in the day, I think I've confessed to you, I take my sparkling water, whether I do it at the Soda Stream or I get it out of the Pellegrino glass, and I just water down my wine.
The conventional wisdom would be that when you add water to wine, that you have watered down the wine.
Yeah.
But in reality, what I've learned is that a little bit of water added to wine will actually cause that wine to blossom in most cases. The way that it's been explained to me is that the alcohol, especially in high alcohol wines, the alcohol is masking some of that flavor.
Yeah, I think that part is probably absolutely true. But the truth is, you know, wine, you think about it, if you have a 15% alcohol wine, it's 15% alcohol and it's 85% water. I mean, remember, there's all those flavors and flavonoids and all that stuff, but that's not percentage of liquid. So if it's 15% alcohol and 85% water, what's wrong with 13% alcohol and 87% water? So all you're really doing is adding what Mother Nature adds to wine through the grapevine.
Do you as a winemaker ever add water to the barrel?
Not to the barrel.
At what point would you do
that?
In
the fermentation tank before we start making the wine.
Okay.
Yeah.
And how much might you add?
Oh, very little.
Just a little bit.
Just a little bit. If you think that the potential alcohol will be something like 15 or 16% and you rather it were 14%, just add a little water right then and there.
What happens?
You're just doing what Mother Nature didn't do in the vineyard.
Have you ever put too much?
No.
Have you ever made a mistake?
Not with water.
Okay, all right.
Yes, I've made mistakes, okay, but not with adding water.
All right. Hey, listen, we're going to have to take a little break for a second, but I got more questions about this in just a second. We're talking to Eugenia Keegan, and we are at Grand Moraine in Willamette Valley. Took me, I think, 3 years to learn how to spell Willamette right.
How long did it take you to pronounce it right?
Am I doing it right?
Yes, you are. It's Willamette, damn it.
Oh, Yeah, that's exactly how I learned it, as a matter of fact. Anyway, we're going to be back with more Grape Encounters from Grand Moraine right after this.
Your special edition of Grape Encounters will continue from Northwest Oregon in just a moment. Perhaps you should pour one of Oregon's world-class Pinots to get you into a perfect frame of mind.
I was too far from home. I gotta get back to Oregon. Too far to roam. Trying to get back to Oregon.
Back with Grape Encounters Radio, and you know, once in a while, you get to sit down with a living legend. And this is one of those days for me, as I get to sit down with Eugenia Keegan, who is winemaker, I imagine general manager of this facility as well, right?
Yes.
You're the boss here.
This facility and the other three facilities. So I've got four wineries.
Yeah, that's right.
Have a hands full.
And we haven't even got to that yet.
Nope, haven't even gotten to
all
that yet.
So let's just kind of give people the whole picture of the structure of things here.
Yeah.
And you can tell that we are actually, what do I hear? Trucks in the background.
Trucks in the background, yep. No, we're in farm country.
Just to prove that we really are not sitting in the studio making this up.
This is the studio. You have great graphics.
Yeah, well, we were responsible for simulating man landing on the moon.
Oh,
years ago, yeah.
So this vineyard thing isn't that big a stretch.
Yeah, we did that in our studio.
Yeah.
But anyway, you work for Kendall Jackson.
Yep.
And such a well-known name, but I think, you know, such a well-respected big brand.
Yes. So I work for Jackson Family Wines, and I make that distinction because
Kendall
Jackson is only one brand of over 45 brands, 45 wineries that the Jackson family owns around the world. And there's no question Kendall Jackson is the largest brand by a long, long, long stretch. And its success is what allows us to have all these other wineries, these very small estate wineries like Grand Moraine. But Jackson family started investing in Oregon in 2013. They came up here in 12 and started to research, made their first wines in 12, purchased three vineyards in 13, and then this little winery, Grand Moraine, and this 35-acre vineyard that's right outside here that we're looking at in the fake studio that we're in here, all those vines.
It does look real, doesn't it?
It looks real, doesn't it? Yeah, it looks awfully real. And since the original investment, they have continued to invest in Oregon. We bought the Penarash Winery just over a year ago, and that's also in Yamhill.
And a great name, too.
A fabulous name. And Lynn is still very involved. Her husband, Ron, couldn't retire fast enough. And if you want to find him, look for a body of water, and you will find Ron and his kayak out doing what Ron loves to do most. But Lynn is still very involved in our winemaking program. And then just last October, we bought the Willackenzie Estate Winery, also here in Yamhill.
That was my introduction to Oregon wine.
Really?
Yes. Yeah. My brother and sister-in-law had come up here. They bought me a membership in the wine club. And up to that point, I thought I didn't like Pinot. And then I tasted those, and they were just so delicious. And I went, oh, so it's not all Pinot. It's just some Pinot.
Yeah. Pinot has been a very challenging variety for us to navigate over the years.
You mean us, meaning winemakers in general?
The whole West Coast, everybody working on this project. We started a program in 1979 called Steamboat. Well, it wasn't called Steamboat then, but we started it actually in Carneros with a group of Carneros friends. And we talked to each other. It was about what's not working here. Why are we not making great Pinot Noir? We knew what great Burgundy tasted like. So why couldn't we do anything near that? And after it was started in Carneros, went to Oregon, back to Carneros, came back to Oregon, and Steamboat is a fishing lodge outside of Eugene, and we hold the conference there every year. But for 35 years, we Pinot Noir winemakers from around the world get together once a year
to ponder
and open the kimono.
This question,
talk about
what's the problem? Why is it not working out the way we want it?
Correct.
Did you discover the answer to that question?
We discovered a lot of answers, and I think you see it in the bottles of wine that we make today. We went from making really almost undrinkable wines in the mid-80s to making some of the greatest wines in the world now.
So I'm going to ask you to tell me three of the answers. What were three things that were holding back Pinot?
The first thing was where you planted it. So you had to go to a cool climate. And remember, in those days, most of the planting in Napa Valley was in Napa Valley, was up in Rutherford and St. Helena, too hot. And Carneros was just becoming active at the time. And Russian River was barely a footnote in those days. So where you plant it.
Okay.
Number
two.
One, how you handle it in the cellar. We used to make it like Cabernet. We would punch down or pump over very aggressively.
Okay. Explain to those who don't know what that means,
so
what you're talking about.
So the juice of red grapes is white. And you all know about Gallo making a white Grenache. And most of you know that Grenache is red. Zinfandel is a red grape, but most people know of white Zinfandel. If you remove the skins immediately upon picking, you will have white juice. And it is the juice sitting on the skins where all of that color is, the color and the tannin, which we call phenolics. Those are in the skins. And by macerating, by pushing the skins and the juice together.
You can't say that word on radio.
Oh, I'm sorry. But you can say the F word, right?
That's no, you
okay
can't
now,
say that.
But you can't say macerating.
Okay. All right. Okay.
Okay. We do a lot of macerating in the winery, just so you know. And as you are macerating with either pushing the cap down into the juice or pumping it over, you end up getting the color into those wines.
Right.
And we used to try and make it like Cabernet, which is macerated often. Those cab guys, you just can't take them out in public. And so over time, we have learned how to handle the grape in the cellar, which is to treat it much more gently, just doesn't respond to the kind of treatment that you would give a Cabernet.
And not
grape.
Only that, you've prevented a lot of blindness.
And hairy palms.
I so wasn't going to say that. Okay.
Well, I so did.
Oh, God. Okay. That's number two.
Number three.
Wait. I'm sorry. Let me go back just for 1 second, though.
So you want to talk about maceration again,
no,
don't you?
No, it's not that. The lesson, though, is to be gentle, right?
Correct. It applies to all things.
Why wouldn't you want to be gentle with Cabernet? Why wouldn't you want to be gentle with Merlot? Why wouldn't you want to be gentle with Syrah?
They don't want you to be gentle.
Yeah.
They want to be beaten up because that's how you get all of the incredible extract and all of the really rich flavors that you're looking for. The thing that's interesting about Pinot Noir is it is missing 13 of the color components that you get in the other reds. And that's why you get why Pinot Noirs in the glass have that translucent color and that light red. It's like humans and the colors they have, the pigments that they have in their skin or in their hair. These are pigments. And Pinot Noir does not have 13 of these pigments, these blue-purple pigments that give you these deep colors that you get in Cabernet and Merlot and Cab Franc and Syrah. So it is always going to have this ruby garnet lighter red color because those pigments are not available in that skin.
But isn't that why they made Mega Purple?
Well, it is
never
a potential
mind.
Use for Mega Purple, but most Pinot Noir guys wouldn't actually
probably
try and do that.
You wouldn't get invited to that Steamboat conference.
That's correct.
I'm sorry, Bill, you can't come.
You cannot come. Yeah, that is not an appropriate use of Mega Red. But it also doesn't have the tannin because the tannins and the colors are linked together in that grapevine, so it doesn't have those tannins. So as you push that Pinot Noir vine, those grapes, all you're going to get is a bitterness component. If you do the same type of technique in Cabernet, you're going to continue to get those colors and those flavors. So they really are structurally quite different. And we had to learn that as winemakers and how to handle that fruit.
Very interesting. You know, that's a lesson I hadn't learned. Mm. And then there's a third one.
And then number three really is about how you handle it in the cellar. Again, Cabernet, we would rack every quarter. You put it in the barrel for 2 years, and every quarter you want to rack it because it needs to be aerated. If it sits on its lees in the barrel, it ends up getting funky and you get off smells and aromas. So the tradition in Cabernet is to rack it every quarter and to deal with that. You don't do that with Pinot Noir, and in fact, you don't want to do it. You don't want to be exposing it to the air like that because you'll be oxidizing it and turning it slightly brown. Cabernet has all those tannins, and they're preservatives. They prevent the Cabernet grape from oxidizing when you're doing that racking process. They're very, very different. They're both red grapes, but you handle them very differently.
Very interesting. Okay. I want you to stay with us for a few minutes because I am so fascinated.
You're at my place, so I really can't leave.
I know, but I'm sending you out over our airwaves. Your place, my airwaves.
Okay. Can I stay on your airwaves?
Yeah, you certainly can. You could be a co-host of this show, for goodness sakes.
Wouldn't that be fun?
You're such a wealth of information. We are with Eugenia Keegan, and we are at Grand Marang, and we are going to be back in just a second. You can hang with me for a few more minutes, right?
Will do.
Because I still have more of those personal questions.
Can't wait.
Okay. All right. About racking. All right. We'll be back with more Grape Encounters right after this.
This special Grape Encounters visit to the Willamette Valley will continue in a couple of minutes, so don't go anywhere. And now, Grape Encounters with David Wilson continues.
With Grape Encounters Radio. If I ever wanted a co-host, I think it would be Eugenia Keegan. Except we would never get anything done. I don't know. Are you like this all the time? You're hysterical.
Pretty much.
You're hysterical.
Except when I'm asleep.
We're at Grand Moraine, and we were talking a little while ago before we got sidetracked for about the umpteenth time. We were talking about the Jackson family umbrella and the wonderful wineries that are under that umbrella here in the Willamette Valley.
Right.
What's it like going from having your own winery to working with such a huge brand? Did you have any reservations about doing that? I mean, honestly.
Well, actually, no, in that there is one big difference, by the way.
I know exactly. I know what you're going to tell me,
yeah,
too. Can I guess?
Yeah.
The health plan.
You know, it's part of it. But money. They have money.
They have money.
Yeah. And it really helps to have money when you're trying to build a brand and build a winery. But when I was asked to do the Grand Moraine brand, which was our first independent brand in Oregon, it was really unprecedented. I was handed one of the most spectacular vineyards that you could ever look at, the Grand Moraine Vineyard. It's 200 acres outside of Carlton, stunningly beautiful. And this unbelievable facility that we're sitting at today, which is a beautiful small winery designed to do only one thing, make the highest quality Pinot Noirs. So the winery is designed to do that. And I was told, go make wine. Make good wine. No, make great wine. And quality is the bottom line of making wine for Jackson Family Wines. And they give you the tools to do it and the freedom to do it. And I think the freedom is the part that surprises most people.
Okay, so this is really amazingly interesting because I've never had this conversation with a winemaker and it never even occurred to me to even ask the question. When you're an independent winemaker and budget is everything, and, you know, I mean, honestly, I know a lot of really, really poor winemakers. I don't mean poor that they don't make good wine. I mean that it just costs a lot of money to make wine.
It's a hugely capital intensive business.
And especially when you're first starting out.
Right.
You know, you can be broke for a really long time.
You have to finance two or three or four vintages before you ever sell something.
So what is it like to suddenly have that freedom where you need something, an important tool or, you know, piece of equipment or whatever, and they say yes? Yes, well, of course, you can have that. Eugenia, blank check. Probably don't say that.
They almost do. They're almost that generous. But the first thing is you don't have any excuses anymore
to make bad wine.
Don't have any excuses.
Hadn't thought about that.
Because you have all the tools. So there's no real excuse to make bad wine. It's a sense of relief because you are allowed, as whether you want to consider yourself a scientist or an artist or a craftsman, a stylist, whatever your particular specialty is or the way you as an individual look at winemaking or all of the above, you have the freedom to do that. You don't have to leave the winery to go sell wine because somebody's selling it for you. So you can be there to babysit your wine. All you have to do is take care of your wine. You don't have to put your kids in daycare while you run off to go to work. You're allowed to stay there in the winery doing what you do best and paying attention to the wines.
Can you give me an example of one or two things, perhaps, that you would never have bought for yourself as an independent winemaker that working for a bigger brand, you could say, wow, I could have one of those and it would make all the difference?
Well, there are things. So Grand Moraine is a very specialty winery in that it's designed just to make high-end Pinot Noir.
Yeah.
But generally in wineries, you have to do more than one thing. And the minute you do that, you're building in compromises because the press that you want for Pinot Noir is not the press necessarily that you want for Chardonnay. Can you use it for both? Absolutely. Is it done all over the world all the time? Absolutely. But in the fantasy world, you might want a different piece of equipment, a different press, a different size tank. White wines, it's nice to have tall, thin tanks. Pinot Noir and reds, it's nice to have short, fat tanks. So sometimes you don't get the luxury of all of that. Here we have the luxury of that, and we get to buy equipment that is the best suited for what it is we're trying to do. And that makes a big difference. Probably in terms of what would I buy? A forklift. The forklift is the most important piece of equipment at a winery, and most of us rent them. or rent them during harvest. So it's something that you have on site all the time.
I had heard that you used a little red wagon, like a radio flyer, move wine around until you came here.
When I was in Russian River. But once I moved to Oregon, where it's more sophisticated, I got a real tractor.
You got a real tractor?
Yeah, a real tractor.
What is it like working with a brand that has the kind of talent that you see at Kendall Jackson and Jackson Family Wines?
Yeah, we have the most unbelievable group of winemakers. And we have a wine growing summit each year. This year it was in Napa Valley. Last year it was here in Oregon. Year before it was in Monterey. So we get around to the different regions. And we bring together all of the winemakers and the vineyard managers. It's a great opportunity to crosstalk. And we bring in outside specialists and we talk about all the new innovation and technology and all of the new research that's being done all over the world. And we learn with each other and from each other. But there's probably 85 or 90 people at this conference.
And it's amazing.
It's amazing. And this is some of the most incredible winemaking and grape growing talent anywhere in the world. And it's all pulled together at Jackson Family. And it's a luxury, in a way, to work for JFW because you are handed the tools. The number one goal when you come to work at a winery is safety. Number two is quality. Number three is sustainability. And it's a very straightforward message. And you don't really question what it is you're supposed to be doing because you know what the answer to the question is. But you're given the tools to do all of the above.
Well, we are running out of time. So I want to do one thing before we say goodbye to you.
Yes.
Let's just run down the Oregon-based brands that you're responsible for and explain to people where they can get them, how they can find them.
Yeah.
Because that sometimes is a challenge for people.
Yes, absolutely. So number one is La Crema, and most everybody knows La Crema, California. But when Jackson Family came up to Oregon, the first brand that they created up here or brought with them was La Crema. So there is a series of La Crema Willamette Valley wines.
I'm curious as to why they would have a California version versus an Oregon version in lieu of just creating a completely different brand.
I can't really answer that question because we have since created brands, but I think it was just La Crema is known for Pinot Noir. They make Pinot Noir all the way up and down the West Coast. And truly, if you forgot about the state line, it's a natural progression. If you're making Pinot Noir from Santa
point.
Rita,
yeah.
Why wouldn't you go straight up the coast? And that's what they did. So it's really the arbitrary state line that gets people to...
How long will it take to get to the Canadian border?
Not long. I think we'll be up there in
a month or two.
Yeah, we'll be up there soon.
I had heard that Jackson Family was going to actually buy Canada.
I think it's an escrow.
Okay, next brand.
Next brand. So then we started the brand Grand Moraine, and we started the brand Zena Crown.
Wait, what does Grand Moraine mean, by the way?
A moraine is a geological term, and it's from the end of glacial activity. It's the trailings that are left behind after glacial activity. And when Jackson Family bought vineyards in Oregon, they bought a vineyard named Grand Moraine, named by the previous owner. Barbara loved it. Barbara Banky, the owner of Jackson Family Wines.
Yeah.
And we kept that name and built a brand called Grand Moraine here at this facility. We have a brand called Zena Crown. We bought a vineyard called Zena Crown in the Eola Amity Hills, which is south of us, a little bit cooler climate, absolutely stunning vineyard. So we built a brand called Zena Crown. We then bought the Siduri brand, and Siduri started making wine in Russian River in 1994. And most people don't realize that they started making wine in Oregon in 1995. So Adam Lee and Ryan Zapaltis, the winemakers, previous owner, still make their wine, and they have been up in Oregon for a number of years. Then a year ago, we bought the Penarache brand, which has been up in Oregon for 20 years, run by Lynn and Ron Penarache. Lynn is the first woman winemaker in Oregon and one of the absolute leaders and pioneers. And then last October, we bought Willakensee Estate. And so we have the six brands now up here in Oregon.
Scooping up some of the really great brands here in Oregon.
Yeah. And, you know, people are ready to retire. And in both the cases of Willakensee and Penarache, they had kids that were completely not interested in owning or operating a winery. Probably had seen their parents sacrifice for so many years. So it was the logical thing to do is that if you want to retire, you sell.
And I guess it's going to be very hard if you built a brand and you do sell it. You know, you want to sell it to somebody like the Jackson family that is, you know, really going to protect the integrity of that brand. And they're really known for that. I know that.
And the land.
And the land, yeah.
Yeah. Incredible stewards of the land. Real estate is a big part of what we do, vineyard real estate. And it's the only thing Jackson Family does, which I think is also interesting. We don't invest in real estate in New York and golf courses here. And we do one thing. We grow grapes and make wine. That's what we do. We work at perfecting it every day. So it's very focused in that way.
Do you have any contact with the Russians?
Well, of course. They're interfering with my winemaking on a daily basis.
Well, you know, it's really funny. You never hear people talk about it, but President Putin has a winery.
Hey, we've been putting bad things in our wine for a long time.
No, you have not. All right. I think the humor is dead, and so the interview is over. You're very funny. Okay. Well, listen, hey, it's been a great pleasure to be here with you.
And David, it's been great to be with you, and
thank you
for taking your Odyssey to the Willamette Valley.
I didn't take the Odyssey to the Willamette Valley. I came here for an Odyssey, actually.
Oh, good. And how's it working?
I think it's just really kicked into high gear.
Awesome.
After being with you.
Wonderful.
Thank you very, very much, Eugenia Keegan. If you've had fun listening to this interview, Google her, because you'll learn a lot more about a very interesting player in the wine business here, both in Oregon and in California. And we're going to say goodbye for a few minutes, and we'll be back with more Grape Encounters right after this. Say goodbye.
Thank you, David. Goodbye.
Your special edition of Grape Encounters will continue from Northwest Oregon in just a moment. Perhaps you should pour one of Oregon's world-class Pinots to get you into the perfect frame of mind.
We like to talk about wine.
All right, we are back with Grape Encounters Radio, and now I am so pleased to move our tour of Oregon winemaking here in the Willamette Valley to a wonderful place called Torrymoor, and we are going to get a French perspective on Oregonian winemaking. And I want to welcome to the microphone Jacques Tardy.
Thank you, David.
So, Burgundian, correct? That's where you started.
I started in Neuilly-Saint-Georges, Burgundy, yes. My parents had the vineyard winery, and I'm eighth generation winemaker.
Eighth generation?
Yes.
And why are you not there?
Married an American girl.
Oh, no.
So, no regrets.
Is there some other member of the family there to keep things going?
All the family is still in France. My brother took over the business after my father passed away, and eventually retired, asked me if I wanted to go back, and I said no.
No.
So eventually he sold the winery and the vineyard.
And so it stops at eight generations.
Well, for this line of the family, yes, but I still have cousins, uncles that are still in the business.
Down the line, the Tardy family is continuing to make wine.
Yes. You'll still see the Tardy name on labels in France.
So speak to me about the difference today between the Pinot that's made in France and the Pinot that's being made here in the States. And I guess we have to differentiate between places like Oregon, Sonoma, let's say the Russian River Valley, the central coast of California. You've been around. Which do you think best represents the original intentions of the French Pinot makers? Or is it just completely different here?
I think Northern Willamette Valley is definitely the closest to my recollection of the Burgundies. California tends to make richer, thicker, more intense Pinot Noirs. Oregon is more known for the elegance and the fresh fruit quality of the grapes versus the heavier, jammier wines. Well, nothing wrong about those wines, just different wines.
For me, I think it's fine to interpret a wine any way you wish. It's just like if you had a chef cook you a piece of fish, a piece of halibut. You know, if every chef made the halibut exactly the same way, there would be no reason to go to anything but just one restaurant, right?
That's great.
But I sometimes am taken aback when people talk about varietal correctness, because especially with Pinot, there is such a swing between one style and another style. How do you feel about that? Do you feel the sky is the limit?
Well, I think it's open to any winemaker. This is a free country, and there are few rules. You can do basically anything you want, including blending other grapes in your Pinot Noir if you wish. But for me personally, it's 100% Pinot Noir. It's all about elegance, complexity, softer tannins, more towards what I remember from Burgundy.
The winemakers who make Pinot seem very focused on the nuances between the different clones and different terroir.
Yes, I think this is the follow-up on Burgundy. We're all trying to imitate Burgundy, if not replicate those kind of wines. But we are fortunate to have our own terroirs, you know, and we're in the Dundee Hills, and definitely makes softer, more juicy Pinot Noir, very soft, velvety tannins.
Yeah.
Sometimes when I make blends, I buy fruit from Eola Hills, Chelan Mountains, and I make a blend that's called deux verres, meaning two wine glasses. That's our reserve line. And I try to use as much Dundee Hill fruit as possible, but I always find that the wine is a bit weaker than I wish. So I end up adding some more tannic wine from the Erla Hills or Chile Mountains to broaden the shoulders of that wine.
Yes.
For me, Pinot is not about fruit. It's about elegance and complexity.
Okay, so for the person who's listening and they hear you say the word complexity, what does that really mean?
Earthiness, that mossy flavor, that leafy flavor. It has that umami flavor in your mouth. You know you want more. You don't care what it's like.
That is really well put. You know, so many people try so hard to describe the flavors in wine, and I don't think I've ever heard anybody describe the term complexity as being the inability to describe something. It's become so complex that it doesn't resemble anything except what it really is. Do I have that right?
It could be my shortcomings,
I don't think so.
Of vocabulary, but these are the flavors I enjoy, and that's what I really enjoy in older Pinot Noir.
Yes.
Older Burgundies. And I can tell you, when I got married, my uncle had been working at a winery in Burgundy for 44 years. He was a winemaker and opened a 27-year-old Pinot, my birth year, and I could not eat with it. All I did was enjoy the wine. It was so good. So these are the Pinots that most people drink once and spend a lifetime looking for again.
But there are some other wines that you're making, and I'm really interested in talking about those. One is a wine that I'm starting to see show up a number of places, Pinot Blanc. And some people might think that's just Pinot that's had the skin stripped off immediately, but this is a completely different varietal.
Right. It is a varietal. It's not Pinot Noir Blanc. It is Pinot Blanc.
So to the person who hears the word Pinot, is there any similarity between Pinot Blanc? I mean, obviously it's a white wine, versus Pinot Noir.
If you look at the vineyard during the growing season before Veraison, before the change of color on the clusters, you will not be able to tell if it's a Pinot Noir, a Pinot Gris, or a Pinot Blanc.
Really?
Exactly, yes.
Interesting. So if somebody was walking through a wine shop and they saw a bottle of Pinot Blanc, what kinds of wine would they have to like that wine?
I think people who drink Pinot Noir and Chardonnay,
Like Pinot Blanc.
Would love Pinot Blanc, yes. Pinot Blanc tends to be a little bit like Chardonnay. Actually, I would say more fruity and more floral than Chardonnay.
Do we use oak or not?
In this winery, I use oak, but not for the oak flavor. I use oak as a small container for extraction, for improvement of the wine. When the yeast is done fermenting, dies out, falls at the bottom of the container, eventually that yeast will open up and release mannoproteins, the goodies, the sweeter, rounder flavor. So a small container allows you more yeast-wine contact than a tank upright.
All right, last question. I want to talk to you about port-style wines. I haven't seen a lot of that being made here in Oregon, but you make
one
or more.
We only make one.
Okay.
It's made out of a Syrah grape, sourced from southern Oregon, and we produce our own brandy to add to the fermenting grapes to make the port.
And does any of that brandy, just out of curiosity, wind up in a flask?
Yes.
Is that a trend that we're moving toward? Because we also are seeing a lot of growth in the micro distillery world. Certainly that is just taking off right now.
Yeah, I think the feds are loosening a little bit the way to get licenses.
They want the tax money.
Distilleries, yes. So now you see more and more distilleries opening. We actually built our own still and made grappa, and we were stunned by how good it was.
You built your own still?
Yeah, we just had a stainless steel tub. We put a lid on it, and we used a column from the steel for brandy, and it just worked out.
If you had done that 50 years ago, gentlemen with black hats and trench coats would have come looking for you, and they would have axes and guns probably too. Well, listen, it's been a pleasure to talk to you. I really appreciate you coming on with us. If somebody is interested in your wines, can they be purchased online?
Yes, it's torimorewinery.com.
That's T-O-R-I-I-M-O-R, winery.com. And I have had the wine, and the wine is really terrific.
Well, thank you.
Really, really excellent. All right, that is going to do it for Grape Encounters today. My guest has been Jacques Tardy. We will be back this same time next week. We'll see you then.